Hey, it's Jenny Nash, and at Author Accelerator, we believe that the skills required to become a great book coach and build a successful book coaching business can be taught to people who come from all kinds of backgrounds and who bring all kinds of experiences to the work. But we also know that there are certain core characteristics that our most successful book coaches share. If you've been curious about becoming a book coach and 2026 might be the year for you, come take our quiz to see how many of those core characteristics you have. You can find it at bookcoaches.com/quiz. Hi, I'm Jenny Nash, and you're listening to the Hashtag AmWriting podcast. This is a Write Big session where I'm bringing you short episodes about the mindset shifts that help you stop playing small and write like it matters. This one might not actually be that short because today I'm talking to journalist Jennifer Senior about the idea of finding and knowing and claiming your voice, a rather big part of writing big. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2022 and was a finalist again in 2024. Before that, she spent 5 years at The New York Times as both a daily book critic and a columnist for the opinion page, and nearly 2 decades at New York Magazine. She's also the author of a best-selling parenting book and frequently appears on NPR and other news shows. Welcome, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Hey, I got it. Clarify just one thing.
Oh, no.
All Joy and No Fun is by no means a parenting book. I can't tell you the first thing about how to raise your kids. It is all about how kids change their parents. It's all like a sociological look at who we become and why we are so, our lives become so vexed. I would do these book talks, and at the end, everybody would raise their hand and be like, how do I get my kid into Harvard? You know, like the equivalent, obviously, they would do it that way. I'd be like, I don't really have any idea, or how to get your kid to eat vegetables, or how to get your kid to like stop talking back. But anyway, I just have to clarify that because every time
please.
I'm like, no. Anyway, it's a sociology book. Ah, it's an ethnography, you know, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
All right. Like she said, you guys, not what I said.
I'm not correcting you. It came out 11 years ago. There were no iPads then or social media. I mean, forget it. It's so dated anyway, but like, I just,
that's so funny. Yeah. So the reason that we're speaking is that I heard you recently on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, where you were talking about an Atlantic feature story that you wrote called Why Can't Americans Sleep? And this was obviously a reported piece, but also a really personal piece. And you were talking about your futile attempts to fall asleep and the latest research into insomnia and medications and therapy used to treat it. And we'll link to that article and interview in the show notes. But the reason that we're talking, and that in the middle of this conversation, which I'm listening to and I'm riveted by, you made this comment, and it was a little bit of a throwaway comment in the conversation. And, you know, then the conversation moved on, but you talked about how you were taking a particular antidepressant you'd been prescribed. And this was the quote. You said, it blew out all the circuitry that was responsible for generating metaphors, which is what I do as a writer. So it made my writing really flat. And I was just like, hold up. What was that like? What happened? What everything? So that's why we're talking. So can we go back to the very beginning? If you can remember, Jess Leahy actually told me that when she was teaching fifth and sixth grade, that's around the time that kids begin to grasp this idea of figurative language and metaphor and such. Do you remember learning how to write like that? Like write in metaphor and simile and all such things?
Oh, that's funny. Do I remember it? I remember them starting to sort of come unbidden in my, like they would come unbidden in my head, starting maybe in my, the minute I entered college, maybe in my teens, actually. I had that thing where some people have this, people who become writers, have like a narrator's voice in their head where they're actually looking at things and describing them in the third person. They're writing them as they witness the world. That went away, that narrator's voice, which I also find sort of fascinating. But like, I would say that it sort of emerged concurrently. I guess I was scribbling a little bit of like short story stuff Or I tried at least one when I was a senior in high school. So that was the first time, maybe, that like I started realizing that I had a flair for it. I also, once I noticed that, I know in college I would make, when I started writing for the Alternative Weekly and I was reviewing things, particularly theater, I would make a conscientious effort to come up with good metaphors. And like 50% of them worked and 50% of them didn't, because if you ever labor over a metaphor, there's a much lower chance of it working. I mean, if you revisit it and go, oh, that's not, that you can tell if it's too precious. But now if I labor over a metaphor, I don't bother. I stop. It has to come instantaneously or
That reminds me of people who write with the thesaurus open. Like, that's going to make,
forget it.
right? That's not going to work. So I want to stick with this, so that they come into your head, you recognize that. And just this idea of knowing back in the day that you could write, like that you, this was a thing you had, like you use the word flair, like had a flair for this. Were there other signs or things that led you to the work, like knowing you were good or knowing when something was on the page that it was right? Like, what is that?
It's that feeling of exhilaration, but it's also that feeling of total bewilderment, like you've been struck by something, something just blew through you and you had nothing to do with it. I mean, it's the cliche, here I am saying the metaphors are my superpower, which my editors were telling me, and I'm about to use a cliche, which is that you feel like you're a conduit for something and you have absolutely nothing to do with it. So I would have that sense that it had almost come without conscious thought. That was sort of when I knew it was working. It's also part of being in a flow state. It's when you're losing track of time and you're just in it. And the metaphors are, yeah, they were effortless. By the way, my brain is not entirely fogged in from long COVID, but I have noticed. And at first, I didn't really notice any decrements in cognition, but recently I have. So I'm wondering now if I'm having a problem with spontaneous metaphor generation. It's a little bit disconcerting. And I do feel like all SSRIs, and I'm taking one now just because, not just because long COVID is depressing, but because I have POTS, which is like it's postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And that's a very common sequela from long COVID, and it wipes out your plasma serotonin. So we have to take one anyway, we POTS patients. So I found that nicotine often helped with my long COVID, which is a thing, like a nicotine patch, and that made up for it. It almost felt like I was doping. It made my writing so much better. But it's been.
Wait. This is so
I know,
interesting.
it's really
Wait.
weird. I would never have guessed that so much of my writing would be dampened by big pharma. I mean, but now with the nicotine patches, oh, I was like, oh, now I get why writers are smoking until into the night writing. Like, I mean, and I always wished that I did just because it looked cool, you know? And I could have just been one of those people with their jetons or however you pronounce it. But yeah,
Wow. So I want to circle back to this in a minute, but let's get to the first time. Well, it sounds like the first time that happened where you were prescribed an antidepressant and you recognized that you lost the ability to write in metaphor. Can you talk about, well, first of all, can you tell us what the medication was?
yeah, it was Paxil, which is actually notorious for that. And at the time, which I only subsequently discovered, those were in the days where there was no such thing as Reddit threads or anything like that. It was 1999, I guess. No, eight. But so really early, that was the bespoke antidepressant at the time, thought to be more nuanced. I think it's now fallen out of favor because it's also a bitch to wean off of. But It was kind of awful. Just, I would think and nothing would come. It was the strangest thing. There's all this static electricity usually when you write, right? And there's a lot of free associating that goes on that, again, feels a little involuntary. You know, you start thinking, it's like you've pulled back the spring in the pinball machine, and suddenly the thing is just bouncing around everywhere. And the ball wasn't bouncing around. Nothing was lighting up. It was like, it just was strange to be able to summon nothing.
Absolutely. Wow. So you just used this killer metaphor to describe
that. Yeah, that was spontaneous.
Right?
Yeah.
So you said, first you said static energy, which is interesting. Because it's noisy. You're talking about.
Oh, but it's not disruptive noise. Sorry, that might seem like it's like unwanted crackling, like on your television. I didn't really. Maybe that's the wrong metaphor, actually. Maybe the pinball is sort of better, that all you need is to, you know, psych yourself up, sit down, have your caffeine, and then blam, you know, but I didn't mean static in that way.
I understood what you meant. There's a buzzy energy.
Yeah, right.
Flow.
It's fizz.
Fizz. That's so good.
Yeah.
So you recognized that this was gone.
It's so gone. Like the TV was off, you know.
And did you?
Or the machine, you know, was unplugged. I mean, it's.
Yeah. And did you? I'm just so curious about the part of your brain that was watching another part of your brain.
Right? There, you know what? I think, that's really interesting. But are you watching, or are you just despairing because there's nothing? I mean, I'm trying to think if that's the right.
But there's a part of your brain that's like, this part of my brain isn't working.
Right. I'm just thinking how much metacognition is involved in, I mean, if you forget a word, are you really like staring at that very hard? Or are you just like, shit, what's the word? If you're staring at Jack Nicholson on TV and you're like, why can't I remember that dude's name? Which comes to me like far more regularly now. I guess 56 than I used to. You know, I don't know. There is a part of you that's completely alarmed, but like, I guess you're right. There did come a point where you're right, where I suddenly realized, oh, there's just been a total breakdown here. It's never happening. Like, what is going on? Also, you know what would happen? Every sentence was a grind. Like, my sentence, it was like, why is this so effortful? When you can't hold the previous sentence in your head, suddenly there's been this lapse in voice, right? Because like, if every sentence is an effort and you're starting from nothing again, there's no continuity in how you sound. So, I mean, it was really dreadful. And by the way, if I can just say one thing, sorry, now that I'm
thinking. No, I love it.
Yeah, sorry. Now you've really got me going. I'm just like, now I'm sort of on a tear and a partial rant, which is Prozac. There came a point where like every single SSRI was too activating for me to sleep. But it was, of course, a problem because being sleepless makes you depressed. So you need something to get at your depression. And SNRIs, like the Effexors and the Cymbaltas, are out of the question because those are known to be activating. So I kept vainly searching for SSRIs, and Prozac was the only one that that wound up not being terribly activating besides Paxil. But it too was somewhat deadening. And I wrote my whole book on it.
Wow.
All fun is not all metaphor.
it's not
all mediocrity and no memorability and nothing memorable. You know, I mean, it's kind of a problem. It was, I can't really bear to go back and look at it.
Wow. So the feeling.
I'm really giving my book the hard sell. Like, it's out of date and it's really a B+ in terms of its pro. I mean, you know, it wasn't. Yeah.
So you recognize it's happening, and what you recognize is a lack of fizzy, buzzy energy and a lack of flow. So I just have to ask now, presumably, well, there's long COVID now, but when you don't have, when you're writing in your full powers, do you, is it always in a state of flow? Like if you're not in a state of flow, do you just get up and go do something else? Like what, how does that function in the life of a writer on a deadline?
Okay. Well, am I always in a state of flow? No. I mean, flow is not, I don't know anyone who's good at something who just immediately can be in flow every time.
Yeah.
It's still magic when it happens. You know, when I was in flow, almost out of the gate every day, the McElveen story. Like I knew when I hit send, this thing is damn good. Mm-hmm. I knew when I hit send on a piece that was not as well read, but is like my second or third favorite story. I wrote something for the New York Times called Happiness Will Not Save You, about a pioneer in, he wrote one of the foundational studies in positive psychology about lottery winners and paraplegics and how lottery winners are pretty much no happier than random controls found in a phone book, and paraplegics are much less unhappy than you might think compared to controls. It was really poorly designed. It would never withstand the scrutiny of peer review today. But anyway, this guy was like a very innovative thinker. His name was Philip Brickman. And in 1982, at 38 years old, he climbed, he found his way to the roof of the tallest building in Ann Arbor and jumped, took his own life. And I was in flow pretty much throughout writing that one too.
Wow. So the piece you're referring to that you referred to previous to that is what Bobby McElveen left behind, which was a feature story in The Atlantic. It's the one you won the Pulitzer for. It's now made into a book. It has like,
although all it is like, you know, the story between
covers, right?
Yeah.
But
which is great because then people can have it rather than look at it online, and it goes on forever. So yeah.
So this is a piece, the subtitle is Grief, Conspiracy Theories, and One Family Search for Meaning in the Two Decades Since 9/11. And I actually pulled a couple of metaphors from that piece because I reread it knowing I was going to speak to you. And I mean, it is just so beautifully written. It's so beautifully structured, everything. But here's a couple of examples for our listeners. You're describing Bobby, who was a 26-year-old who died in 9/11, who was your brother's college roommate.
And young adult. You can't afford New York. They were living together for 8 years. It was foreign college in four.
Wow.
New York City. They had a two-bedroom, and a cheaper part. Well, to the extent that there are cheaper parts of the way over near York Avenue East Side. Yeah.
So you write, when he smiled, it looked for all the world like he'd swallowed the moon. And you wrote, but for all Bobby's hunger and swagger, what he mainly exuded even during his college years was warmth, decency, a corkscrew quirkiness. So just that kind of language, a corkscrew quirkiness, like he'd swallow the moon. It's that the piece is full of that. So that's interesting that you felt in flow with this other piece you described and this one. So how would you describe, so you describe metaphors as things just comes, it just happens, you're not forcing it, you can't force it. Do you think that's true of whatever this ineffable thing of voices as well?
Oh, that's a good question. My voice got more distinct as I got older. It gets better. I think a lot of people, writers' powers wax. Philip Roth is a great example of that. Colette? I mean, there are people whose powers really get better and better. And I've gotten better with more experience. But do you start with a voice? I think you do. I don't know if you can teach someone a voice.
So when you say you've gotten better, what does that mean to you?
I'm trying to think, like, do I write with more swing? Do I just with more confidence because I'm older? Being a columnist, which is the least creative medium,
Yeah.
750 words to fit onto. I had dedicated space in print. When David Leonhard left, I took over the Monday spot during COVID. It's really, really, but what it forces you to do is to be very, your writing becomes lean and and structure is everything. So this does not relate to voice, but I was always pretty good at structure anyway. I think if you, I think movies and radio podcasts are like great for structure, storytelling podcasts are best thing to, I think I unconsciously emulate them. The McElveen story has a three-act structure. There's also, I think the podcast Heavyweight is sublime in that way.
Is that Roxane
No,
Gay?
no,
No.
no, no, no.
Oh, it's
It's Jonathan Goldstein.
yes, got it. I'm gonna write that down and link to that in our show notes.
I'm trying to think of, because his is like narratives, and it's got a very unusual premise. But voice. I worked on making my metaphors better in the beginning. I worked on noticing things. And I worked on, I have the, I'm the least visual person alive. I mean, this is what's so interesting. Like, I failed to notice once that I had sat for an hour and a half with a woman who was missing an arm. I mean, I came back to the office and was talking, this is Barbara Epstein, who was a storied editor of the New York Review of Books, the storied editor, along with Bob Silver. And I was talking to Mike Tomasky, who was our like City Politic editor at the time, and I said to him, I just had this one, I knew he knew her, and he said, was it awkward with when you with her having one arm and everything? And I just stared at him and went, one arm? I am really oblivious to stuff, and yet visual metaphors are no problem with me. Riddle me that, Batman. I don't know why that is. But I can like summon them in my head. And so I worked at it for a while when my editors were responsive to it. Now they come more easily. So that seems to maybe just be a facility. I started noticing them in other people's writing. So Michael Ondaatje in, I think it was in The Skin of the Lion, but maybe it was in The English Patient. I read like every book of his. Like I've, running, or was it Running in the Family, Running with the Family? I think it was Running with the Family, his memoir. And I mean, it doesn't, everything, Anil's Ghost. Was it The Ballad of Billy the Kid? Anyway, I can go on and on. He had one metaphor talking about the evening being as serene as ink. And it was then that I realized that metaphors without effort often end, or is that a simile? That's a simile.
Like, or if it's like or as, it's a simile.
Yeah, so I'm pretty good with similes, maybe more than metaphors, but serene as ink, I realized that what made that work is that ink is one syllable. There is something about landing on a word with one syllable that sounds like you did not work particularly hard at it. You just land on it and keep going. And I know that I made a real effort to make my metaphors do that for a while, and I still do sometimes. Anything more than that can seem labored.
Oh, but that's so interesting. So you noticed in other people what worked and what you liked,
Yeah.
and then tried to fold that into your own work. So
Yeah.
does that mean you might noodle on, like you have the structure of the metaphor or simile, but you might noodle on the word
The final
that
word.
the final word?
The actual simile or whatever. Yeah, I guess it's a simile.
Yeah.
Sometimes I sometimes they, like I said, they come unbidden. I think I have enough experience now, which may make my voice better, to know what's crap. And I also, by the way, I'll tell you what makes your voice better. Just being very willing to hit select all delete. You know, there's more where that came from. I am a monster of self-editing. I have no problem doing it. I like to do it. I like to be told when things are shit. I think that improves your voice because you can see it on the page.
Yeah.
And also I think paying attention to other people's writing, you know, I did more and more of that, you know, reverse engineering stuff, looking at how they did stuff as I got older. So
I was going to ask a question, which now maybe you already answered, but the question was going to be, you said that you feel like you're getting better as a writer as you get older. And you said that was due to experience. And I was going to ask, is it, or is it due to getting older? You know, is there something about literally living more years that makes you better? Or, you know, like, is wisdom something that you just get, or is it something you work for? But I think what I'm hearing is you're saying you have worked and to become the kind of writer who knows, you know, what you just said, you delete stuff, it comes again. Tell me, you know, you welcome the kind of tough feedback because you know that makes you better. You know, this sort of real effort to become better, it sounds like that's a practice you have. Is that
right? Oh, yeah. I mean, well, let's do two things on that. Please, I so easily lose my choo-choo these days that, like, you've got to, you know, if you can put a, you know, oh God, I'm going to use a cliche again. If you can put a pin in or bookmark that, you know, the observation about, you know, harsh feedback, I want to come back to that. But yes, one of the things that I was going to keep, when I said that I have the confidence now, I also was going to say that I have the wisdom, but I had too many kind of competing, you know, running at once. And I had, you know, many trains on many tracks, like, about to leave. So, like, I had to sort of hop on one, but, like, the confidence and wisdom. Yes. And also, like, I'll tell you something in the McElvain piece, it may have been the first time I did like a narrative nonfiction. I told a story. There was a time when I would have hid behind research on that one.
Ooh, when, and did you tell a story? It was I remember reading that piece when it first came out, and there you're introducing, you know, this situation, and then there's a moment and it comes very quickly at the top of the piece where you explain your relationship to the protagonist of the story. And there's just a moment of like, oh, we're really in something different here. There's really is that feel of this is not a reported story. This is a lived story. And that there's so many layers of power, I mean, to the story itself, but obviously the way that you present it. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And by the way, I think writing in the first person, which I've been doing a lot of lately, is not something I would have done until now, probably because I am older and I feel like I've earned it. I have more to say. I've been through more stuff. It's not like with the same kind of narcissism or adolescent, like, I want to get this up. You know, more searching, I think, and because I've seen more, and also because I've had these pent up stories that I've wanted to tell for a long time. And also, I just don't think I would have had the balls, you know. So some of it is, and I think that that's part of, you can write better in your own voice. If it's you writing about you, there's no better authority, you know, so your voice comes out.
Right.
But I'm trying to think of also, I would have hid behind research and talked about theories of grief. And when I wrote It's the Damnedest Thing, the dead abandon you and then you abandon the dead, I had blurted that out loud when I was talking to, actually not Bobby's brother, which is the context in which I wrote it, but to Bobby's, I said that, it's like right there on the tape, to his former almost fiance. And I was thinking about that line that I let it stand. I didn't actually then rush off and see if there was a body of literature that talked about the guilt that the living feel about letting go of their memories. But I would have done that at one point. I would have turned it into this because I was too afraid to just let my own observations stand. But you get older and you're like, you know what? I'm smart enough to just let that be mine, like assuming
Right.
it's got to be right. But can we go back also before I forget?
Yeah, we're going to go back to harsh, but I just want to use your cliche, put a pin in what you said, because you've said so many important things that there's actual practice of getting better. And then there's also wisdom of just owning, growing into, embracing, which are two different things, both so important. So I just wanted to highlight that you've gone through those two things. So yes, let's go back to, I said harsh and maybe I misrepresented
you
what
might
you
not
meant.
Have said that. I don't know what you said.
No, I did. I did.
You did. Okay. Yeah. Cause I just know that it was processed as a harsh. Oh no, totally. Like I was going to say to you that. So there was a part of my book, eventually I just gave one chapter to each person in my life who I thought could like assess it best. And one of them, so this friend, I did it on paper. He circled three paragraphs and he wrote, and I quote, "Is this just a shitty way of saying?" And then I was like, thank God someone caught it. If it was shitty, oh my God. And then, and I was totally old enough to handle it. You know, I was like 44, whatever, 43. And then, who was it? Someone else. Oh, I think I gave my husband the intro. And he wrote, he circled a paragraph and just wrote, ugh.
Okay.
Hey, select all, delete, redo, you know, like, okay. What are you going to do with that? I mean, that's so unambiguous. It's like, you know, and also, I mean, when you're younger, you argue. When you're older, you never quarrel with ugh, or is this
right? You're just like, okay, yep.
Yeah. And again, you've done it enough that, you know, there's so much more where that came from.
Yeah.
Why cling to anything that someone just, I don't know, had this totally allergic reaction to, like, you know, if my husband broke out in a hive, I'm not gonna.
Yeah. So, circling back to the storyline of you took this medication, you lost your ability to write in this way, you changed medications, presumably you got it back. What did it feel like to get it back? Do you remember that?
Oh God, yes. It was glorious.
Really?
You don't feel like yourself. I think there are many professions that are intertwined with identity. They may be the more professional, I'm sorry, the more creative professions, but not always, you know? And so if your writing voice is gone, and it's, I mean, so much of writing is an expression of your interior, if not life, then I don't know, some kind of thought process and something that you're working out, to have that drained out of you, for someone to just decant all of the life out of your, or something to decant all of the life out of your writing. It's, I wouldn't say it's traumatic. That's totally overstating it, but it's a huge bummer. It's, you know, it's depressing.
Well, the word glorious, that's so cool. So to feel that you got back the you-ness of your voice was glorious. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know what? If I can just say, I wrote a feature, right? That then, like, I remember coming off of it, and then I wrote a feature that won the News Women's Club of New York story for best feature that year. Like, I didn't realize that those are kind of hard to win. And it's not like I've won, I think I've won one since, but like that was in like 99 or something. I mean, like, you know, I don't write a whole lot of things that win stuff until recently. you know, there was like a real kind of blackout period where I, you know, I mean, but like, which I think had to, it probably didn't have to do with the quality of my writing. I mean, there was, but I mean, you know, I wasn't writing any of the stuff that floated to the tippy top. And like, I think that there was some kind of explosion there of like all the, again, stuff that was just desperate to come out. I think there was just this volcanic outpouring.
So you're saying now you are winning things, which is indeed true. I mean, Pulitzer Prizes among them. Do you think that that has to do with this getting better, the wisdom, the practice, the glorious having of your abilities? Or I guess what I'm asking is like, is luck a part of all that? Is it just happens? Or do you think there's some reason that it's happening? You feel that your writing is that powerful now?
Well, luck is definitely a part of it because the Atlantic is the greatest place to showcase your feature writing. It gets so much attention, even though I think fewer people probably read that piece about Bobby McElveen than would have read any of my columns on any given day. The kind of attention was just so different. And it makes sense in a funny way because it was 13,600 words or something. I mean, it was so long. And columns are 750 words. But like, I think that I just lucked out in terms of the showcase.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a part of it. And the Atlantic has the machinery to, you know, and all these dedicated, wonderful publicity people who make it possible for people to read it, blah, blah, blah. So there's that. If you're older, you know everyone in the business. So you have people amplifying your work. They're suddenly reading it and saying, hey, everybody read it. It was before Twitter turned to garbage.
Yeah.
So social media was still a way to amplify it. It's much harder now. So
yeah.
Passing things along through social media has become a real problem. But at that moment, it was not.
Yeah.
So that was totally luck. Also, I don't know, I wonder if it was because I was suddenly writing something from in the first person and my voice was just better that way. And I wouldn't have had like the courage, you know. And also,
yeah,
when you're a book critic, which is what I was at the Times, and you certainly are not writing from the first person. And as a columnist, you're not either.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are very kind of constricted forms. And they're also not, there are certainly critics who win Pulitzers. I don't think I was good enough at it. I was good, but I was not good enough. I could name off the top of my head like so many critics who haven't even won anything yet. Like Dwight Garner really deserves one. Why has he not won a Pulitzer? He's, I think, the best writer, him and Sophie Gilbert, who keeps coming close. I don't get it. Like, what the hell?
Do you, as a reader of other people's work, I know you mentioned Michael Adachi, that you'd studied him, but do you just recognize when somebody else is on their game? Like, do you recognize the voice or the gloriousness of somebody else's work? Can you just be like, yeah, that?
Well, Philip Roth, sentence for sentence. Martin Amis, even more so. I cannot get over the originality of each of his sentences and the wide vocabulary from which he recruits his words. And like, maybe some of that is just being English. I think they just get better, kind of more comprehensive. They read more comprehensively. And I always tell people if they want to improve their voice, they should read the Victorians. Like his also facility with metaphor, I don't think is without equal. The thing is, I can't stand his fiction. I just find it repellent. But his criticism is bangers and his memoirs are great. So I love them. I read him very attentively. Trying to think of like other people who's Kenneth.
I guess I was getting at more
people
like
as they
genius, like genius recognizes genius, that concept. Like when you know you can do this and write in this way from time to time, anyway, you can pull it off.
Yeah, genius is, we can't go.
That's the cliche, right?
But oh, like, no, I know. Game recognizes.
Game recognizes game yeah, is a better way of saying it. Like, do you see, that's actually what the phrase is. I don't know where I came up with genius, but.
No, it's fine. You can stick in anything in that template. You know, evil recognizes evil. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's like.
Do you see it? Do you see it? Like you can see it in other people?
Sure. Oh, yeah, I see it. Yeah. I mean, you're just talking about among my contemporaries or just as it...
just like anything, like when you pick up a book or you read an article or even listen to a storytelling podcast, that sense of being in the hands of somebody who's on it.
Yeah, I think that Jonathan Goldstein, I mean, I think that the Heavyweight podcast for sure is something, and more than that, it's storytelling structure. It's just that I think that anybody who's a master at structure would just look at that show and be like, yeah, that show nails it each and every time.
I've not listened, but I feel like I should end our time together. I would talk to you forever about this, but I always like to leave our listeners with something specific to reflect or practice or do. And is there anything related to metaphor or practicing, finding your voice, owning your voice that you would suggest for folks? You've already suggested a lot.
Read the Victorians.
Awesome. Any particular one that you would say start with?
Yeah. You know what? I find Dickens rough sledding. I like his, you know, dear friend, Wilkie Collins. I think No Name is one of the greatest books ever. I would read No Name.
Amazing. And I will add, go read Jennifer's work. We'll link to a bunch of it in the show notes. Study her and watch what she does and learn what she does. That it is a master at work, and that's what I would suggest. So thank you for joining us and having this amazing discussion.
This has been super fun.
And for our listeners, until next time, stop playing small and write like it matters.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.